Welcome to the Success in Medicine podcast. I'm Dr. Rajani Katta, author of the best-selling residency match guide, The Successful Match, and creator of the Residency Interview 101 course. This is a special series on the podcast called Energized at Work. We hear so much about burnout in medicine, and it is a real and very challenging problem. That's why I wanted to learn from doctors in all types of specialties who are the opposite of burned out. These are the doctors who are energized by work. I'm looking forward to sharing lessons and secrets from these doctors on this special series. I am so honored today to have on the podcast Dr. Lavanya Pundit. One of the reasons I really wanted to interview Dr. Pundit is because she is a physician scientist. She is currently a full-time staff physician at the Michael E. DeBakey Veterans Affairs Medical Center in Houston, Texas, where she also serves as the director of the Pulmonary Hypertension Program. She is, in addition, an associate professor of the Baylor College of Medicine, involved in mentoring and teaching. And her research centers on physiologic and molecular mechanisms of pulmonary vascular disease. So I'm really excited to dive into this conversation. And thank you so much, Dr. Pundit, for joining us today.
Oh, absolutely. Thrilled to be part of this ongoing conversation.
Well, I wanted to start by just asking you if you could share what a typical week is like for a physician scientist.
Oh, such a great question. And it's not a typical thing that we are exposed to during our training in, say, medical school or residency. So it is a new set of skills that you kind of gain towards the end of that long journey of training to become a physician. So the scientist part of it adds that sort of novelty to my week. I am in an academic practice, and I have, other academic partners, and we are assigned, our priority is clinical service, serving our patients, which in my case are the veterans who served our country. So my primary responsibility is when I am assigned clinical duties at the DeBakey VA Medical Center. And for me as a pulmonary critical care physician, that could mean inpatient procedures and consultation on patients hospitalized with pulmonary diseases or taking care of patients and training physician scientists or trainees in the ICU. If I'm not on clinical service, which is my primary responsibility, then I have academic time to perform research. And the kind of research I do is a combination of what we call bench research. So I'm actually in the laboratory bench, as a scientist, doing experiments, thinking through and planning experiments and analyzing data with my team. The other part of my research besides the bench research is clinical research. So we're actually interfacing with patients, or we call them research subjects, for example, people who are interested in contributing their time, maybe their samples for research, or treating them with experimental therapeutics to progress science. So depending on my week, if I'm on clinical service, I'll either be in my lab with my team discussing data, science, performing experiments with them, maybe training new lab members, discussing human research regulatory issues with my research coordinators who are also on my team, and they're trained in ethical conduct of research. I will schedule time during my days to also mentor other younger physicians, whether it's helping them come up with a research project where they can be productive and learn how to ask scientific questions, write up abstracts that they can then disseminate to the general public. And that's just a good skill to have, even if they're not going to do any research ever again in their life. It trains them to be good thinkers and discerning physicians. And then the final thing I do, that I just love to do is take care of patients that I talked about. It all comes back to that. My journey as a scientist always began at the bedside, taking care of patients. So I still really, really enjoy doing that. And I still keep a once a week clinic in the pulmonary hypertension center. So even if I'm not assigned to ICU service or inpatient service, I always staff that pulmonary hypertension clinic once a week. And I have fellows that enjoy working with me, and we have a whole clinical team. And very proud of that program because it's veteran-centric and we've built it up from the bottom.
Yeah, and I actually want to ask you a little bit more about the pulmonary hypertension clinic because that is a program that you started. And when we discussed this before, I was surprised that something like that had not existed previously. Tell me a little bit about what inspired you to begin a program like that. And I'm also going to ask you because I think it's wonderful to be sitting here and to hear about such a program. But we're not really getting the full spectrum of what it took to get to this point. So you saw a need within your department and you decided to make this happen. So tell me a little bit about what inspired you and what brought you to this point.
So I think, Regini, I am a questioner. I always question. My default mode is to not accept something right away, but to kind of wonder, why do we think that? Why do we think this way? So even as a resident in training, when we would see patients in the ICU, and I am an ICU doctor, and many ICU doctors like physiology. It's the ultimate way how the body works in the ICU, and we have to replicate that. So I would see patients come in with complications from pulmonary hypertension. And when I did residency, there was very little still understood about this disease in terms of mechanism. And as a result, fewer therapeutics. In the last 15 years, just an explosion of science behind this disease and recognizing that there are complications from pulmonary hypertension. In the 1980s, the NIH classified pulmonary hypertension as an orphan disease. That's basically a way for those of us who do this thing, we don't know much about this. So it's been an exciting time to be a doctor who cares for these patients. We have a little bit more in our armamentarium to help, but still a lack of understanding in what causes the disease, who gets the disease, and then primary prevention, who's at risk, really stifles progress in taking care of these patients. And veterans, as it turns out, are in a high-risk group. They are enriched with the risk factors for people who go on to develop pulmonary hypertension and unfortunately may die from it. And that just wasn't being recognized. Veterans, even though we have a very robust healthcare system for the veterans in this country, they are still considered an underserved population. We are trying to expand veteran services to rural areas, but the top quality cares that we see in top medical centers are not always available. So, what started off as an inquisitive, perhaps rebellious questioning turned into a real urge and motivation to provide care, high quality care for really complicated diseases to the people who served our country. It was as simple as that. Pulmonary hypertension care is usually provided at highly specialized medical centers in urban environments. And in fact, they're called pulmonary hypertension centers. They are accredited as that and require highly specialized, obviously, physicians, pharmacists, nurses, and a hospital that's able to provide diagnostic capacity. Most VAs don't have that. And so it began as a local effort to provide our veterans in Houston top quality care so that they didn't have to leave the VA to do it. The other option that I saw as an opportunity in starting this is to create a community of pulmonary hypertension specialists within the veteran-centric system. And very proud we, have started that and we collaborate all in an effort to really improve access to education in the rural areas and share resources, collaborate to help extend knowledge, treatment, and research now, which is my love for pulmonary hypertension. I think if you can identify this problem in the veteran population, which is a specific community enriched population, you actually serve the general global population better if we can study it in a very specific population first and expand it. So that was the long story, essentially.
And then how did you make this happen? You started collaborating with others and you were able to convince leadership. I mean, they heard your idea and they said, yes, let's start this today. I mean, that's probably how it went.
Sure. Yeah, very easy. Just a few emails and phone calls. You know, like most things, a combination of a lot of persistence and a bit of luck. And, you know, when I say luck, that encompasses knowing the right people. And I have really the good fortune of being at a very, very collaborative VA in the pulmonary and cardiology departments at DeBakey VA. So my chief of staff is a cardiologist and an expert in advanced heart failure, Beacom Bosgaard. Our head of medical care line affairs is one of my former, you know, partners and colleagues in pulmonary critical care, Charlie Land. So they both understand the immediate clinical need. So I didn't have to do any convincing to them because that's their field. So that was very lucky. But then they also believed in me. And I was, you know, coming up in the ranks as a junior faculty. I'd gotten a little bit of visibility with some grant funding through the federal government and in this area. So there was a little bit of validity to my approach. So a lot of persistence, a little luck, and the help of really good friends. Just continuous emails. I didn't let things go, honestly. And then just built up. And if I may be so blunt, I didn't always ask for permission. You know, I would just, you know, say to one of our nurses, hey, you know, would you like to help me with this program? And she said she'd be absolutely happy to. And she would talk to her supervisor to start it off. So I tried to enroll other people in the idea through my own excitement and dedication. And I think that's what enabled us to grow forward without a lot of permission. I just sort of moved forward and found people who believed in what I did.
Isn't that so interesting? Because I speak to so many medical students who are really passionate and driven to make a difference. And yet you have to combine that passion with really practical approaches on how do you bring something into being? And what you're just discussing, the necessity of collaboration, of pulling other people into your mission, and persistence, you mentioned that several times, is really required. So I love that you're mission driven, but that you're also have been very practical and persistent in bringing that to fruition. That's such a good lesson, isn't it?
It is. And I think, you know, it's so easy to be stopped by noise. And that noise can take really the form of anything. It could be a thoughtless statement. It could be an email. It could be just other challenges in your life. And that's okay. I mean, those can also exist at the same time. My purpose was still very constant, if it were. And I really just was interested and believed in this. And that's what kept me going in anything, but particularly creating a program. If you believe in the program, people will come, people will believe in it with you. And then you start to have small wins. And this is important, Rajni, we've talked about this. Obviously the effort that you put in has to be, you know, great. But when you start to see and reap some benefits, you do need to disseminate that, those wins. And so whenever we would have even a small win, like we reached our first, you know, milestone of seeing 50 new consults referred to the Pulmonary Hypertension Center, I sent an email to my boss and I said, hey, look, these are 50 veterans that got highly specialized care that would not have existed before the existence of this clinic. It's only 50. But I let her know, and she was more than happy to be my cheerleader. The leadership. So you do need to toot your horn when it's important. So you do reap the benefits more from those efforts than just you sitting in your corner and, you know, with your little team going, yay. I mean, that's important too. And then also giving credit where credit is due. If my nurse practitioner was enhancing the program with her idea to create video follow-ups to improve adherence to medications, then I'm going to toot her horn to her supervisor and say, hey, look, this tele program that she recommended has definitely improved care. Kudos to the nursing program. So I think, really reaping and highlighting your successes and giving a lot of credit to your team members, whether it's through their bosses and for food, showing gratitude. It's simple enough, but it goes a long way. So I do actually reflect on this. I mean, it may sound corny, but every month we sit with our team and I sit with my research team and my clinical team, and we just like on a Friday, there's usually not clinics Friday afternoon at the VA. We will spend a half an hour and people can bring their lunch. We can bag it or we can order it. It's very casual. And we do a kind of reflection on our gratitude. What are we thankful for? What are we just grateful for? And things may not have gone great that month, but we just sit and just reflect on what we have accomplished as a team. And it also helps me know where my team's at, and maybe I need to acknowledge them more, So we do that. I mean, it's a very informal thing, but you maybe call it gratitude rounds.
Oh, I
So
love
yeah,
that.
once a month we do that, and it's very informal, but I've gained a lot of perspective from it. As our team has grown too, I've gained a lot of perspective.
Okay, so this is very interesting because you just dropped several like wisdom nuggets right there. I mean, how to approach this as a leader and to really think about and raise up your team, but also the fact that so many of us coming up in medicine, self-promotion is not necessary. That's a bad word, right? But in the way you're describing it, it's not self-promotion so much as it is, this is a win that all of us achieved together, and I want to keep you in the loop. I want you to be aware of this as well. And pulling in those collaborators. That's awesome.
I think, and okay, I this has been said. I'm gonna just say it. As women in
Yeah.
science, we do not promote ourselves enough. I don't know, and perhaps this is a generalization, and so be it, but this is my observation. And I
Yeah.
have a wonderful mentor who is a female scientist, and I think her one criticism of me, and you need that person who's your champion but is really honest with you to this day when she reviews my grants with me, just because I always give her a look at it. She's like, you're holding back. Just get to the point and say this is really important research. Just say it. Just say what you've done and say this is important. So I still do that. I hold back. I don't know if it's just the nature of medicine, calls us to be humble and serve, but there's
Yeah.
no need to do that if it's holding back progress. So I've had to learn that, really. And I'm still a work in progress.
Interesting you say that because when you have an important mission that you are trying to work towards, you don't necessarily think about all of the other things that are very important to completing that mission. I think what you just said, having a champion to talk about you and your progress, but also having somebody who is very honest with you, that can be one person or two people, but it's
Right.
really important to have those people on your own team. And along the same lines, I did want to ask you one of the things, you and I have been long-term friends, and I know COVID was incredibly challenging for everybody who was on the front lines, and especially for somebody who was a pulmonary critical care physician in the ICU, treating patients, treating even colleagues who were hospitalized. How did you handle the stressors of the pandemic?
That's such a thoughtful question, Rajni. And yes, you were one of the important people in my life, along with others who did support me and others who were in my position. Everybody in this world was affected by the pandemic. And pulmonary critical care teams had a unique perspective, certainly. on the front lines. I also had a unique and privileged perspective in some ways. I can look back and say that as a scientist, really trying to impact human existence in a absolute way. Usually in science, when we're trying to figure something out or answer a question, whatever answers that may come out and help humanity occur way after a scientist has outlived it, has lived. So you won't see the benefits of your work. But in this case, as a scientist, we were able to really see the impact right away. So as much as it was draining to get up in the morning and go to work and be there as a team leader, whether it was for my clinical team, the trainees, or the scientific team, we did feel like we were making an impact. My co-scientific leader, who really recruited me into that, is an ID physician and clinician scientist named Barbara Trotner. She is now my boss at the VA. And again, one of those champions in life, she saw potential in me that I cared. I was, in a practical sense, the ideal person for her to collaborate with because I literally was seeing these patients, up front and personal. But it turned into opportunity. Something that was very painful turned into an opportunity to help humanity in a big way. So as much as it was hard to see, frankly, death, suffering, and everything that we all experienced the pandemic, and certainly my family was going through stress. Despite it all, I'm fortunate that I can now look back and say, as a professional and as a scientist, it was an incredibly robust time of development, growth. And as a scientist, I was able to grow philosophically that, the reason we ask questions, the reason we promote that idea of asking and improving and wanting to progress our humanity. These are big questions, but you can do your small part and sleep okay at night. And I think for me, I just really took it one day at a time. And the science actually gave me a reason to get up and come to work every morning. Truly.
Wow. Isn't that amazing? And I also have thought about the fact that sometimes you are put in a situation where what you are bringing to the situation is very valuable. And you, as a clinician and as a scientist, those experiences helped. I know you were on several clinical trials, and one of the trials for treatment for COVID patients was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, and you were first author on that paper. And I think, you having these two particular skill sets, being in this moment in time that you were able to take that and produce something that was helpful to so many people, that's pretty remarkable.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, obviously, everything is a massive group effort. But again, a little bit of luck knowing the right people who saw something in me. I think they saw that I was a hard worker and a bit, a bit irritatingly optimistic, perhaps. So I just wouldn't give up in that sense. I just show up to work every day. I mean, I think we all had to kind of figure out our path during the pandemic. We had to figure out how to get up and go in the morning, whether it was, creating TikToks for joy. I mean, whatever it was that we all had to do. I don't mean to get deep about it, truly. It just was about
No.
sometimes getting up and showering and going in the morning. So.
No, but you're absolutely right. I mean, there are days and weeks where it is, I mean, you have to think about what is getting you up and out of bed that particular day. Well, I also wanted to ask you some advice about the physician-scientist path, because I was just reading an article about the really dramatic drop in the United States of physician scientists. And There are apparently multiple reasons for this drop, but what they're stating that at the current time is only 1.5% of US physicians are physician scientists. And among many other challenges, research funding being pulled in multiple directions. What, as a physician who practices medicine and performs scientific research, and you know all the challenges that are related to that combination, what advice would you have for medical students who are interested in pursuing this path? And I am going to interject here that you do not have a PhD. So you are an MD who became a physician scientist, not an MD PhD. So for students who are considering this pathway, what advice would you have for them?
Yeah, so this is something that's near and dear to my heart. So I'm so glad we're talking about it. Ultimately, being a physician scientist is about understanding why you want to inquire about human disease. And if you're not, if you want to heal, and if that's your superpower, healing, because I mean, there are those of us in our field who are amazing at that. They are so gifted at healing, whether it's with instruments, their hands, their voice, their ability to think through something, find the lesion. I mean, there, if you are a healer who has a very specific knack or joy at healing, then do that. If you are a healer who also asks a lot of questions, it's bothering you why we heal in this way, or could we heal better? And you want to be at the forefront of that. And you have to be very honest about what is your motivation in that? Is it, and somebody once told me this, I'm going to give credit to a mentor. Is the motivation in asking questions to truly answer the question, or is it to become famous for answering the question? Because if
Interesting.
it's about being famous, then you're going to be very goal-oriented about publishing, getting funding, and that's getting harder. That's getting really harder to do. So if the goal is to be famous, and there's nothing wrong with that goal. I mean, there is absolutely nothing. That is a very motivating thing. Self promotion, self-acclamation, there is nothing wrong with that. By all means, go for it. And some of our greatest accomplishments as humanity has come from that hubris, And so let's own that, But if that is the main motivation, then I think all young scientists, whether they're MDs or PhDs, they need to understand that that part, the famous part, is getting increasingly rare. You can't do that in the traditional ways of working at a large medical center. You will need venture and partnership between public and private, basically money, 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 and support. So that scientific support, that training, that ability to not depend on, somebody giving you funding to conduct research so that you can, have dinner that night. You don't have to have that stress. So the dependency on funding to create that fame and self-acclimation is dwindling because it's just not accessible to people. It's a smaller pot. And so I think we saw some silver linings though, because with COVID, there was just a explosion of public and private partnership because humanity demanded it. We needed solutions for our survival. So what do I mean by that? The government and private enterprise banded together their resources to just do large scale trials and help scientists and clinicians come together to just more efficiently answer the questions. So, recruiting 3,000 patients for a vaccine trial, that takes money, that takes expertise, that takes coordination, that takes a lot of people and resources. So when you have public and private working together, that can happen. That doesn't usually happen. COVID taught us how well we can do that if we want to. So we have to incentivize more of that collaboration. But until that happens large scale, People do this for their own personal motivation, glory. And if that's not there, then you're doing it because you want to improve and answer a question. I am an MD. I still earn my living mostly by taking care of patients. So my livelihood does not depend on my next grant and funding. A PhD scientist who was a mentor once told me, you're not hungry like a PhD scientist, so you won't be as successful. And although, it was a little bit cheeky the way he said it to me, I understood what he was trying to say, which was you need something to push you. You need it's either your own personal glory or that you need to break bread, So something needs to push you to be a scientist these days, because that's the supply is, the resources are dwindling, the supply is dwindling. So unless we see that explosion of collaboration again that we saw during the pandemic when we were pushed to do it, there was a motivation there for public and private partnership. I am not surprised that the number of clinicians, why would you? What's pushing you to do it? You can take care of patients and be a perfectly good healer and still earn a living and sleep well at night, relatively speaking. But if you're a scientist, you need something to push you, and that's getting harder to do. Very, very difficult to do in the traditional academic institutions. And I think we've seen that with fraud, right? People will go to any lengths to get their name out there, to stay abreast.
That's been very concerning. But I'm glad you're giving sort of an insider view of what the situation is, because I think when you're thinking about becoming a physician scientist, I don't think from the outside looking in that we realize how much grant writing that you have to do, and how much how that is kind of a constant cycle of preparing for the next round of grant writing. I mean, that is quite a bit of what you have to do. You write so much, correct?
Yes, yeah, more than I thought I would when I started medical school. You and I have similar age kids, and I said, work on your writing because you'll use it for everything. And even with, AI coming out, you still have a human voice, and the AI is only good as what we input in. So your voice, your ability to communicate ideas is still essential. So it's a very important skill. I never thought I'd be writing this much.
Oh, that's such good advice, because nowadays, from the other side of it, where I'm working with medical students who are preparing for the residency match, and so they have to have publications and presentations, and they have to participate in some type of research. I am also surprised by how much everybody needs to be working on their writing skills, even at the very initial stages of research.
Yeah, and I think that the current technology actually will help us to be more productive with our writing. I don't see it as a conflict. I think we can actually enhance our writing, maybe get us started on our writing more, maybe encourage those who normally wouldn't write to start writing. That's the way we disseminate ideas. And I say writing, but Rajini, as you know, podcasting is another form of communication. So, writing and communication as a general tool of dissemination of knowledge is important. And I look forward to, ongoing generations improving that communication in ways beyond the written page. But still, your ability to communicate complex ideas simplistically and effectively is so important. And writing is, the first way most of us have access to that.
That's very profound, because every day in clinic, that's what we are doing. Like, just starting at that building block, communicating complex ideas in simplistic terms to our patients, and then taking it to other audiences. Oh, well, Dr. Pundit, I could talk to you forever. I feel like we have barely scratched the surface, but I just want to say thank you so much for sharing your experiences and your honest experience as well. We really appreciate it. I know my audience does too.
Anytime. Very happy to have had this conversation with you.